The Rev and the Rabbi, every Sunday at 8 a.m., sponsored by Power Express Mortgage. Power Express Mortgage Bankers is licensed by the NYS Department of Financial Services and is an equal opportunity lender. NMLS 1324.
The sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Rev and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I looked at the calendar today. You and I, and everyone at WABC Talk Radio, we are all working for John Catsimatidis. It is official. He is the new owner of the station, which means we have to shop at Gristiti's. We have to bring our own bags.
What does that mean?
No plastic bags, you know. Anyway, I spoke to John during the week. It's a new chapter, and he certainly is well prepared. So we'll hopefully see.
I think he's going to continue a tradition of great broadcasting, great shows like The Rev and the Rabbi, and the other shows as well. Hopefully that's what's going to continue to happen.
Well, John is a person who appreciates people who care and have a commitment, mm-hmm. and we're surrounded by so many here at WABC. So I expect to see that there's a presumption of continuity. All right.
Absolutely. That's the way it should be. Continuity, legacy, and destiny. You and I were talking about that.
Yeah, yeah. So let me just say this. You know, the prophet Isaiah said, "Woe to those who, you know, confuse darkness with light, light with darkness." I watched the debate this week, and I walked away astounded. I was astounded by the fact that a Bernie Sanders could find good things about Castro and negative things about Netanyahu. You know, I'm saying light, dark, dark, light. And as a proud Jew, and I speak to many of my people who just are shocked that here you are, you have this opportunity, you know, you're running for president. We always say, can there be a Jewish president? And we have a guy on the stage who does so little for his people over the years. There's very little connection, although, he's now has a video about being a proud Jew, whatever. It's very disheartening to see and to hear these kinds of comments and to see someone who's surrounded by people who support BDS and Hamas and all of that and Farrakhan, not where we need to be, not a very encouraging moment for many of us. So we'll see how this all plays out. But
well, you know, as we look at that debate, it was quite spirited. My friend Michael Bloomberg came out a lot stronger. Mm-hmm. I think he did a lot better than he did in the first debate. You know, but as people look at these candidates, they still have to work through a process of deciding who will best speak to their values, to their priorities at the end of the day, and who can get things done if they do become president.
Right. Record of accomplishment counts for a lot. Resume counts for a lot. You know, when you're in Congress for 30 plus years and you haven't got anything done, you haven't passed anything, that's a serious deficiency.
Is that a shot at Bernie or what?
Yeah. Look, I don't endorse. I just non-endorse. But I think we spent time, you and I were talking off the air, you know, stop and frisk and all these other things. And that was, but today there are issues that we need to confront directly. And yeah, we can spend some time looking at the past. We've gone through this again and again, but that's, you know, there comes a time when you got to move on as well.
Yeah, but I think why there's so much pushback from the community of color with regard to stop and frisk is because people who were victims of stop and frisk are still experiencing the effects of it. So if you end up getting a record, right, or you got arrested, and maybe during the stop, question, and frisk, there was a small amount of marijuana that was found on you, and now there are bigger problems created by that. But once you have a record, Rabbi, you know what happens. You know, it affects employment.
Right.
It affects housing. you know, it's just so many things that it impacts for the rest of the life of these individuals. So, it's something that's in the past. We've got to move on, but we have to deal with the reality of the effects of stop and frisk. And I think that's what is causing people, you know, such consternation.
Yeah, look, as you know, Michael Bloomberg said, there were abuses of the system, clearly, and that was wrong. But there are also, you know, many positive aspects to stop and frisk. I was reading an article by Reverend Michael Faulkner. You know Michael.
Yeah, I know Michael. Yeah.
Matter of fact, he played for the Jets years ago. And he said stop and frisk was a good thing in many ways for the communities, especially communities of color. You know, the crime rate was high in those areas. Black leaders were coming and saying, we need to do more to protect our communities.
It's a double-edged sword because The reality is that people who live in high-crime communities, all right, they live in a tension. I've said this in past broadcasts in this season. Mm-hmm. They live in a tension between the need for police presence, all right, to deal with crime, and the other side of that, over-policing. So they want police presence, right? But over-policing results in issues like a disproportionate number of Black and Latinos ending up arrested and incarcerated. So it's that tension, you know, and balance should, between those two, should be the guiding principle. But anything taken to the extreme becomes error and produces the kind of results that stop and frisk produce.
You know, I'm all in favor of people pointing finger at others who, you know, they feel have traveled on the wrong path. But I also want to see people looking at themselves. You know, Elizabeth Warren comes on and she goes after Bloomberg again. It's not as if she has this snow white past. I mean, she's the one who lied about, you know, her status, Native American. That's just glossed over. I just think this kind of self-righteousness to me is, I don't like it. I don't like the constant looking at someone else and not looking. By the way, that happens not only in the political stage. It happens in the religious stage where people are always judging someone else's religiosity and not their own.
And look, this is a cancel culture. If we don't like something, we want to cancel it. If we don't like a person, we want to cancel it.
Right.
But it speaks to the level of threat that Mike Bloomberg presents to Elizabeth Warren and some of the most of the other candidates, because, you know, his first time out the gate, his first debate, you know, everybody went after him. They all piled on him.
Yeah.
You know, that's reality. And look, at the end of the day, all right, everybody on that stage is morally compromised in some way. You know,
absolutely. That's
something with
all of
us.
That's why we go to houses of worship very often during holy days. We ask for forgiveness. We ask for forgiveness from one another. It's very easy. It's very easy for me to accuse you of a wrongdoing as long as I don't have to look at my own. Right.
I
just, you know, and I see this measuring other people's religious behavior and ignoring your own irreligious behavior.
Wait, you mean glass houses, throwing stones? Is that the way it goes?
But I don't, you know, people throw stones and they do it with this kind of religious haughtiness. So this kind of, you know, but
self-righteousness,
not me. It's not me. And let's look very carefully. Let's put the microscope on everybody. Let's scrutinize everybody's behavior. And no one is going to come out 100% innocent. It just doesn't work.
But they got more into the issues this last debate. I mean, there was more conversation about the issues and policies, et cetera. And I think that was a big shift from the first debate that Bloomberg was a part of.
But we also,
and that's what we need to talk about. What are the policies? What are the issues?
And that's why we need moderators who control it more. You know, there's got to be a very strict time limit, and then your mic goes off. We're not going to hear you because this continuous, just, you know, talking over someone else, not listening to someone else, is irritating. That people want to hear how you're going to confront today's issues, not how you're going to scream at the other person, you know, who did something inappropriate or something, you know, that you found offensive in the past.
Unfortunately, Rabbi, that should be the predominant case, but unfortunately, people want to be entertained. Even by our politicians, even by our rabbis, our ministers, our clergy, they want to be entertained. So if you're not charismatic enough, if you don't carry the stage enough, if you don't holler and make some noise enough. Right. You know, they judge you as being weak, disconnected, irrelevant. You know, and that's the climate. Yeah. That's the world in which we live right now. That's the society in which we live.
By the way, our good friend, His Eminence Cardinal Dolan, said something recently. He said he was going to administer, ashes for Ash Wednesday. And he walked into the church, and there was one line for those to receive ashes. There was another line of homeless people who weren't received, some food. And he said, It's not enough just, it's not enough just to get the ashes. You have to do something to help the other who is suffering. And I think there was a clear message there. Don't just be concerned about the outer appearance. You know, there are people who are hurting very much on the inside. Do something for them. So, you can appear to be religious, but if you're not helping something else, there's something very incomplete, something deficient in your so-called dedication to religion. We don't need superficial religiosity.
Absolutely. And along with the cardinal, because, you had the Catholic, you had the Protestant, I'm Protestant. However, there are parallel traditions that we celebrate, such as the 40 days of Lent. Mm-hmm. And yesterday begins that 40-day period. Begins with Ash Wednesday. We celebrate it in our congregation as well. So we're engaged in prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, which is acts of charity. Mm-hmm. So our congregation makes a commitment not only to pray and to deny, ourselves of some sensual pleasure, whether it's food or social media or maybe fasting from a bad attitude. Some people need to fast from a bad attitude, but also almsgiving. Looking at people who are marginalized, disenfranchised, the least of these in society, what can we do? And that's part of our Lent experience. It should be part of our life, period. Right.
You got to do good. You can't just like good. You got to do good. And in our Jewish tradition, you have Passover preceded by Purim, and it's all about helping, recognizing those who, who don't have and who need, who need you, need your help. You go to the synagogue, but when you walk out, the question is, so what are you doing after you said you care about everyone else when you were inside? What do you do on the outside about, the inside?
Yes, what we call orthodoxy, which is the study, observation, and tradition, and orthopraxy, which is how it's practiced in life.
All right. We have a great guest today, by the way, someone who's talking on a very timely issue, Dr. Michael S. Phillips of NYU, head of infectious diseases. And really someone who I think will bring to our attention things we need to do to protect ourselves during this very, very difficult period.
It's coronavirus, right? Yep, everybody's up in arms with questions and trying to figure out, what do I do? So this should be a great interview.
All right. Stay tuned. Rev the Rabbi.
We'll be back.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, you and I were talking that today we need to have someone on who is proficient in the area of infectious diseases, particularly coronavirus, and we're privileged. Michael S. Phillips, who is the Director of Infection Prevention and Control Unit at NYU. He's been involved many years in public health. He's trained in that area. He's dealt with people who, have experienced all kinds of infectious diseases, and we need him now. We need his erudition, his experience. So thank you, Dr. Phillips, for coming on the air with us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Didn't your mom?
Thank you, Doc.
Didn't your mom tell you to stay away from this area of medicine?
My mom still calls me and encourages me to wash my hands. So I would do the same for everybody else.
Yeah. So talk about this to lay people. What is this virus in terms of, break it down for us and its impact, how it's transmitted?
Yeah.
And if you can, Doc, can you begin, if I may, can you begin with making the distinction between a bacterial infection and a virus? Because they're treated differently. And some people think, we take some antibiotics. But a virus doesn't respond to that. So I'll let you, Doc, just kind of give us the difference between those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a really big difference between bacteria and viruses. You know, some of it has to do with just the way that they're put together, if you will. And antibiotics that are typically given in a doctor's office work against bacteria. There's only a smaller number of medicines that work against viruses like this coronavirus. The thing about viruses that's different than most bacteria is that they can spread easier. And this kind of coronavirus, usually it spreads kind of like the flu does. There's a lot of similarities here to the flu virus or influenza virus. You know, and that is that most times it's people that are in, you know, close contact, like where they're a couple feet away from each other. And it can spread through droplets coming out of someone's mouth. And you can either breathe those in or get it on your skin and touch your face. And that's why, you know, no joke, I mean, washing your hands, particularly before you touch your face or frequently throughout the day, is probably one of the best interventions that we have that we can practically, you know, keep ourselves safe. I would like to emphasize up front, though, that, you know, everybody, of course, is concerned, and I'm concerned also about this coronavirus. I'm not downplaying, you know, what we're facing here by any means. But there are some information that's coming out, you know, of China and elsewhere that's encouraging. First, unlike the flu, this virus doesn't seem to affect children or young people as aggressively as the flu. So, you know, I think that, you know, always in these kind of settings, we're very concerned about young babies and young children. Not to say that we want to take all these protective measures to keep those people safe, and they likely do get these infections, but they don't seem to suffer some of the serious consequences that we see in the flu. And I think that's important for us, you know, to take some comfort in that.
So some of the older people, like the Reverend, would be impacted differently. Right?
Well, it emphasizes, you know, for sure, you know, even though we're seeing a lot less influenza, we still are seeing some flu. And so, you know, if it's available and you can get a flu shot, I would say doing that for sure. But, you know, I mean, so what about the rest of us? You know, I'm not, you know, in the younger age group anymore. You know, how do I stay safe, you know? Well, certainly in the hospital, we take a lot of specific measures to keep ourselves safe because we're taking care of folks that are really highly infectious. But that's not what everybody's going to face as they're out there, you know, living their lives over the coming weeks. You know, I do feel strongly that, you know, we need to take some preparation efforts now because I do feel it is likely that we're going to see transmission of this virus in our New York City communities. You know, I think that, you know, when that does happen, there's going to be some announcements from government and public authorities and such, and that might be quite frightening. And so I think it's good for us to kind of think it through now about what that's going to be like. And, you know, we talked about doing some simple things like, you know, preparing, not hoarding, not, you know, you don't need to, you know, prepare like we're about to have a 1 month long ice storm and you're not going to be able to leave your house. But, you know, certainly having things like medications that you might need, having those little alcohol based hand rub dispensers that you can, you know, when you're traveling, when you're out and about, you know, do that sort of, you know, putting on the hand rub. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this before the call, and, you know, a lot of the messaging, things you're seeing is this social isolation, is staying in your apartment, staying away from everybody. And I can understand that, but I'm also thinking that, you know, going out and taking a walk in the environment, you know, when you're not around anybody, and it's probably one of the best, safest areas, the air is flowing all around you, you know, is a safe thing to do. And so, you know, you wouldn't want to be in close contact with somebody who's severely ill and coughing, of course. But these are the practical things that we can think about when, you know, we're in this situation, and maybe it's a little bit different than we're normal to.
Yeah, but
so let me ask you a question. I'm sorry, Rabbi. You know, besides people who are elderly and in denial, like Rabbi, there are people who wonder, you know, how do you treat this? Because, you know, we hear there's no vaccine. They're trying to find a vaccine. Suppose you get it. I mean, how do you treat it? What do you do?
Yeah. So So to put things in perspective, like, you know, when we think about a flu season, we think everybody gets the flu, right? You know, based on the CDC data, for people that develop symptoms of the flu, that's about 10% or 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 of the American population. So not everybody's going to get this infection. Or if they do, they're going to have such mild symptoms. They're going to have colds and sniffles. They're going to have not feeling well for a couple days. I mean, A, when we're in this kind of setting and you have those symptoms, it's a good reason to stay home, right? Because we don't want to be exposing those people that are vulnerable for more serious infection. So for what are we going to treat it with? For most people, it's going to be mild illness, and we're going to treat it with rest and Tylenol, and et cetera. Now, people that develop fever, people that start to have more significant flu-like symptoms, that's a good reason, and I would say call your doctor or use one of these telehealth medicine things. We have this virtual urgent care that people can call. They get a doctor, they get somebody on the line there that can guide them. If people develop fever and cough and shortness of breath, that's a more worrisome sign of pneumonia. That's when you need to seek care and do so quickly. Now, when people come in the hospital, then we are looking very carefully at antiviral medicines that we use in the hospital, and including some medicines that are produced by Gilead. That's a large drug company. It doesn't matter the name. But we're looking at antiviral medicines that appear to specifically target this virus. We would not use these medicines on someone with mild illness because they're going to get better on their own. But if people develop those warning signs of fever plus cough plus shortness of breath, then they need to be seen, maybe even go to the emergency department, and there the doctors and nurses are going to think about what additional therapy and additional above and beyond supportive care that we would do.
So, doctor, someone traveling the train, reality of life is we don't live as isolationists.
Right.
Right? Someone's going to cough. Someone's going to sneeze. And all of a sudden you have a, you know, panic pervading the area.
Yeah.
So what do you do? You're standing there, the person next to you sneezes, coughs. What do you do?
Well, you just move away. You know, get
have
up
you been on a New York City train lately?
Yeah. Believe me, I take those trains all the time. I know. And, you know, it is one of those things. And this gets to this use of masks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I can tell you that hospitals right now are really looking at every mask they have. And so folks that are just kind of grabbing masks and thinking that's going to help them when they're completely, you know, when they're well, it doesn't work. It's not an effective measure. So in other words, wearing a surgical mask or any kind of mask in that setting and thinking you're protecting yourself, you're really not. However, However, if somebody is sick and coughing and they're starting to feel better and they're ready to go back to work and stuff, but they still have a cough, for that individual to wear a mask, that may be something that we can do to keep our community safe.
So if, you know, like we had the 15-year-old girl who she had flu-like symptoms, her mom left her at home, things got worse by the end of the day, she gets back. The next day, the young girl, 15-year-old girl, dies. Is it from the coronavirus and it was confirmed that that's what she had? Is this because of her immune system being compromised? Because she has a young person who supposedly is strong. Is that an isolated case? How do we think through?
That kind of scenario would be very, very rare. And when I'm talking about pediatric, I'm usually talking about kids that are less than 10 years of age. When you're 15, you're sort of more heading into, if you will, sort of adult kind of hood. But that kind of scenario, what you're describing, would be very rare. But what you also described, though, was a trajectory, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I'm feeling well in the morning, and by lunchtime,
right,
I'm not feeling well. By evening, I'm like, whoa, you know, that's a rapidly evolving event. In that case, even outside of coronavirus, you want to be, you know, making sure that you're seeking care, right? Now, for somebody with, you know, take a similar situation, you know, it was me about 6 weeks ago, you know, I had a head cold, I felt a little feverish but never had a fever, a little muscle aches and pains, you know, I was able to, you know, kind of handle myself at home, I didn't come to work, you know, it wasn't like it was changing or evolving over time, you know, and eventually I got well, you know. then that's a very different scenario, right?
Yeah. So, doctor,
and these things introduce new language to us. Like, why is it called COVID-19?
Yeah.
Explain the language to us.
Well, it's a WHO, which is the World Health Organization's way of indicating these viruses. I think it's a mistake. I think that all caps. We're talking about this with our team here. You know, it's just a mistake. It shouldn't be all capped. When somebody all caps you, it looks like they're yelling at you, right?
Right.
So I'm like, you know,
it's scary.
You know, yeah, of course it is. And what I'm telling you is, yes, there are these, you know, these very rare events of a rapidly changing clinical course where, of course, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's anything, you're going to seek care. And if your doctor's office isn't open, you're going to the emergency department, right?
But
for most people, it's not an all cap. It's a small caps.
Yeah.
It's a stay home. You know, you're going to be watching it moment to moment. You're going to use this virtual urgent care. You're going to be calling, you know, your doctor if you have any questions. You're going to be looking for those warning signs, rapidly changing, or fever and cough and shortness of breath. But for most people, it's going to be, I'm not downplaying this at all, but it's going to be the kind of thing that you're going to get better without any specific treatment.
All right. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. More of The Rev and the Rabbi.
The Rev and the Rabbi skillfully unites religions, faiths, and all people into the most compelling and thought-provoking dialogue each week. Hosted by internationally esteemed pastor, Reverend A.R. Bernard, and renowned rabbi, Joe Potasnik, The Rev and the Rabbi invites everyone from various professional backgrounds and platforms to join the conversation as they discuss how faith fits into our everyday lives.
Welcome back to The Rev and the Rabbi. I'm Rabbi Joseph Tasman.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Doctor, let's look at this from a global perspective. Because going forward, people are going to say, how can we be more preventative? You know, if we had more open relations with China in this area, would that be a step forward here? I mean, can vaccines be developed early on rather than waiting till after the problem has grown?
You know, over the past decade, and particularly the past 5 years, the U.S. government has pumped in a tremendous amount of resources and dollars into developing technologies to allow the rapid development of vaccine. So vaccine, you know, is one of our modern wonders, right? And it allows us to prepare our immune system for what could be a very serious infection before it's even been seen, and it really protects us. Right. If we had a vaccine against this virus right now, we would be using it without hesitation as long as it's safe. And that's really what they've done is they've allowed us to develop this vaccine in a much more rapid fashion in a safe way. But the challenge is even with that, that's a massive undertaking. Even with that, we're talking, you know, on the space of like a year or a bit. Still, that's dramatic improvement. But still, it's not going to help us over the next couple weeks. I would say, though, that, you know, I know there's a lot of back and forth about relations with China, and I'm no expert at that, but they were actually very open in a very important way in that they shared the virus genetic characteristics early on. If you will, they shared the DNA of this virus. That allowed, and they published it in a very standardized way, that allowed everybody across the world to start to develop diagnostic tests that they could use to keep their own people safe. So you know, there's some good stuff.
So people listening to you, doctor, who have planned a trip, going to, you know, any particular area, are they better off delaying the trip? Or are they saying, whatever, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, I'll deal with it? I mean, because they're, you know, people are frightened. There is a genuine fear out there.
Yeah, of course they are. It's absolutely understanding and right to be concerned, you know. Some of it is the reason for travel, right?
Right.
There's reasons that we may have to go. A loved one may be sick, or a loved one may be in a problem situation, and we need to go, you know, go see those people. And there's a personal reason and a personal level to go travel. You know, clearly right now, CDC is posting travel advisories and travel warnings to certain parts of the world. When CDC posts a travel advisory, a travel warning, you know, I would say pay heed to that. Again, thinking about why you're going. So So I think that's a very practical and pragmatic thing.
Go ahead.
That's about it.
I got a ton of questions for you, but economic issues, and I'm not talking about retail establishment losing business, but I'm talking about the cost of test kits, because what I understand in certain places, these test kits, the cost can be so prohibitive to test for the viruses that governments are saying, you know, we're not going to respond, we're okay, because of how much money it's going to cost them.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's really important, though, that obviously we want to test people and see who's having this infection or not. But, you know, when we're in a situation where, you know, we know that it's here and somebody has mild symptoms or they have, you know, a situation that they wouldn't necessarily need to go to the hospital to get hospitalized, you know, we don't need to test in that setting. Mm-hmm. What is kind of interesting for us here is that the flu is still present, but it's going down. So, you know, we'll have that advantage, you know, as in a few weeks, if somebody comes in with what looks like to be a viral syndrome, it could very well be this pathogen. You know, I can't say about the test of causes elsewhere. You know, the good news is that there's a lot of commercial labs that are working on this. And the hopes are, you know, in a few months, that we'll actually have a test that hospitals can use, but right mm-hmm. now they don't. And a really important point is, there's really no reason to come to your doctor's office and certainly not to a hospital to get tested just because you're worried. Because A, they're going to tell you, we don't have a test to give because all the tests right now are going through our public health labs. And B, right. You know, don't come to the hospital if you don't need to, particularly during a respiratory viral season.
Yeah, doctor, you know what it comes across and, talking to Joe Loda, who's, you know, the director of NYU Langone and a good friend of all of us, there's a greater appreciation, I think, now for CDC, for the world of medicine, for all of the study that you have done over the years, you and, you know, your colleagues. I think sometimes we minimize that. You know, if things are going okay, all right, you know, it's another day. But when things are become a little more challenging, all of a sudden you recognize we need to fund CDC. We need to make sure that research continues in a very intensive fashion.
Yep. No, I agree. And I can agree wholeheartedly. And in fact, you know, as mentioned before, that research and very pragmatic steps that were taken, like how do we develop vaccine quickly? How do we do that? And we have much more tools than we ever did before. But obviously there's so much more to learn. Wouldn't it be great if we had the ability to start, you know, giving vaccine to folks that were vulnerable to severe illness with this coronavirus? We don't have that capability right now today, but maybe, you know, one thing's for sure is, you know, we're facing this now, and either us or our kids are going to face this in the future. And this kind of ability to start protecting a lot of people is really what we need, because this is, you know, history tends to repeat itself, particularly when it comes to viruses and infections.
So, right. Doc, the rabbi didn't want to ask, but I'm going to ask on his behalf. And
you take insurance? Is that what?
And the rest of the conspiracy theorists out there, you know, they're asking questions. Can something like this be manufactured in a lab and then spread? You know, how do you respond to those out there?
You know, I mean, you always think about any possibility that could result in this. Everything that we know about the genetic makeup of this virus suggests that's not the case. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, people will be studying this kind of thing in the future for sure. I mean, certainly we know we have the complete virus sequence. We have this virus, so we can detect those kind of manipulations typically. Mm-hmm. Everything suggests it's more likely what we expect with the flu that happens every year, right? This bug lives in animals, and sometimes it makes the leap over to humans, and gosh knows, probably humans are giving animals bugs too, so it kind of goes both ways. You know, and sometimes those bugs are infectious, and they can transmit, and this is the case here. I think that's much more likely, but I'm sure, you know, folks will be looking at these kind of things, but I've not seen any signal. In fact, the basic research on the virus suggests that's not the case.
So just to wrap up, because I'm sure people want to make sure they're doing the right thing, you get up in the morning, obviously, you know, you go through your hygiene routine, wash your hands thoroughly, right? During the day, wash your hands thoroughly.
Yeah.
Right?
Wash your hands or use one of those alcohol-based hand rubs when you can't get in washing.
Okay.
And particularly wash your hands before you, you know, you talk about riding the subway. Ride the subway, get off. Just, hey, listen, put a little Purell on your hand before you, or alcohol-based hand rub on your hand before you go ahead and touch your face.
All right.
Yeah. And we don't realize how often, I became more conscious of it, but we don't realize how often we actually touch our faces throughout the day.
Absolutely. It's really common. So that it's that kind of practical stuff that we all can do to keep ourselves safe.
And prayer.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, certainly, you know, connecting with those communities and connecting with those things that are so important to you, and not forgetting those things, particularly in this kind of event.
All right. Dr. Michael S. Phillips, NYU Langone, who is the Director of Infection Prevention Control Unit at NYU. By the way, I must tell you, people rave about you. I know you're not seeking all these plaudits, but it's really heartening to hear so many good things. And Reverend Bernard, you'd be happy. He's a Christian doctor. I found one in New York. It was not easy.
Oh, wait a minute. He's one of ours? Not one of yours?
Well,
okay.
we all started this R. Well, years ago, we all started as R's, but then, you know, we branched into other areas.
Yeah, we branched.
All good. But
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doc.
Bye-bye. We'll be back after these messages.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Atasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. That was great.
Yeah.
I appreciate
the doctor's forthright presentation. I don't want to hear political spin. I don't want to hear, you know, all of the other, you know, the sideshow. We got to listen to the people who know what they're talking about.
Absolutely.
And people are concerned. They're very worried here.
Yeah, I'm glad he, you know, that's why I asked him about that COVID-19. Because when you hear the terminology like that, it's like a movie.
Yeah. If the doctor says you got COVID-18, all right, it's only 18.
Yeah, like, the 19. Okay, you've got 2 days to live. That's scary stuff.
Yeah.
But these are questions that you ask great questions, Rabbi, because this is where the people are. You know, this is on the ground where people live, and they're trying to figure out, do I get on a train? Do I get on a plane? Do I stay in my house? What do I do?
Yeah. Well, you know, Jewish tradition says before you promulgate a position, go out and see what the people are doing. You got to relate it to the people. You know, there are those who talk in the clouds. That doesn't help those who are on the ground. So I'm thankful that Dr. Phillips was able to speak very clearly and cogently. Yeah. I mean, and there are simple things that we could do, and hopefully by doing those things, we'll emerge from this. Look, we're going to get through this. I think that at the end of all of this, we've been through some very difficult times over the years. We've seen, you know, Ebola, we've seen SARS and some of the others. We'll get through this. We'll get through this because there are people out there who are doing great research, who are really very bright, talented, and they're going to win the day for us. We have to support that effort.
Absolutely. And the economic cost, that's why I brought it up, you know, when it came to the test kits, because in Indonesia, you know, I was scheduled to spend the whole month of May, Taiwan, Sumatra, Jakarta, and Singapore, and I had to cancel. But in Indonesia, you know, the health inspector there, Terawan, said that, you know, look, just eat right, exercise, sleep.
Yeah.
And the bigger issue behind the scenes was the cost of the test kits.
Yeah.
We're talking maybe $4,000 for one test kit for one person.
Yeah.
You know, so there are economics that are driving how nations are responding to this coronavirus.
Yeah. And I think people have to go on the CDC website. It's very important. See what's out there. See the latest information so you can be better prepared. And you know... The fact that we do pray, the fact that we come together as community and have that that optimistic spirit. We know that today is difficult, tomorrow will be a better day. That's our goal.
I'm going to give you a sermon right now.
Go ahead.
The playing field of human experience is not level, and that's why we appeal to God in prayer to level that unlevel playing field.
Well, let me add to that, and we have to do our share. We got to be partners in that leveling process. You know,
yes.
I remember my mother always said to me, to those who say God will help, I ask, who will help until he helps? Get us through that interim period. So we all have to work together. And again, I think people who are so expert in these areas, that's a gift of God as well. when you have these talented doctors who are working, you know, assiduously, they are blessed with that spirit.
Yeah, makes a difference. Great program, Rabbi.
All right, thank you. And next week, stay healthy. And put me on your insurance plan. It's much better than mine.
All right. Until next time, the Rev and the Rabbi. God bless.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to one of the most iconic stations in the nation. An American original. Talk Radio 77. WABC and WABCRadio.com.